Oh, God. Weren't you expecting that?
I call the House Committee on Rules to order and open an informational meeting. Let the record show that a quorum is present. We have a number of witnesses that are going to come talk, and we're going to start having our process on initiative reform today with this meeting. And we had anticipated, but we have one of our members who has another committee that's very important having to do with kindergarten happening very soon, so and full-day kindergarten in the Senate. So if we could first have Senator Morris, it would be appreciated.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for your extension of the courtesy to allow me to testify first. Actually, probably my comments might have been better at the end, but this initiative process
and
is something
be,
that has...
Be sure for the record.
Oh, excuse me. Frank Morris, Senator from District 8, Albany and Corvallis. Colleagues, I appreciate the opportunity to address an issue that has had great interest for me ever since I came into this building in 2003. We were in a financial stress in 2003, as those of you that were here remember, and it didn't take long to go back and look at the impacts of initiatives and their contribution to our spending patterns that had occurred in 2003. And upon further review, looking at the past 16 years, if you end with the 07, and I have not updated the data through legislative revenue, but if you look at the last 16 years, ending fiscal year ending 2007, nearly 50% of the discretionary spending in this state was directed specifically by initiatives. And specifically, Measure 5, 11, 50, 66 and 99. And what we have in this state is a time-honored tradition of access by the public by either referendum of what we do or through initiative. And what I would propose to you is that we in no way should impinge on that right of the public for redress. But what we can do is we can provide a more thoughtful, informed process by what we would refer to as the indirect initiative, so that once the ballot or once the measure qualifies for the ballot by the Secretary of State, that measure then comes to the Legislative Assembly at our next regular scheduled assembly for review in the hearing process. And the proposal and the thoughts are that you apply legislative revenue, you apply legislative fiscal counsel, legislative counsel. All of the resources that are available to us are applied to that measure so that it has a very bright light shining on it, and the intended consequences as well as the unintended consequences are explored. We have the good fortune in this process of, so to speak, not using the analogy maybe appropriately, but a bully pulpit, to the extent that we were very open. Newspapers write about what we do here. There are findings that are made public. And that then would, all of those findings, including the concept that we would make an advisory vote in both chambers, so that the will of this body as representatives of the state of Oregon would become known and be a part and parcel in the voters' pamphlet, so that when voters look at this issue, they will have the benefit of the findings, of legislative findings. Now, several courses of action could happen when the measure comes before the Assembly. One is we could adopt it. That's always a possibility. The second is we could take the Measure 61-57 route and offer an alternative to the voters. I don't think that it would be appropriate in any way for us to attempt or have the right to amend an initiative that has filed. I think that would be a violation of the right of the public. But in the event that we wanted to place on the ballot a more thoughtful or a better alternative, voters would have that opportunity to make that selection. One of the considerations that we're looking at also is that you would, rather than the 5761, and people could vote on both of those, you would have a category where they could say, we don't like either. And if that category had 50% of the vote, then neither of them would pass. So there's work to be done on this bill, but I think what I would share with you, in my conviction, is that we need a more informed electorate, particularly when it comes to the consequences that affect our budget. Voters don't have the depth of understanding that we do and what the choices are, because if we add spending, either it comes out of revenue, hopefully, that our state produces, as in the case of Measure 5. The 90s, the go-go 90s covered the problem with Measure 5, where it just shifted from 30-70 to 70-30, where the state picks up the balance. But voters need to understand that there are consequences, and so... rather than relying on the 30-second sound bites once a measure qualifies and it gets into the campaign mode, to have a more thoughtful process and share that process with voters. So that's basically the intent of the indirect initiative that we're proposing for consideration. And as you know, Representative Galizio and I have been working on this together, and he's changing diapers. Or whatever.
Or whatever.
Coming close anyway.
Yes, yes. Representative Galizio's baby was born. It's a pretty exciting day for him. So surprisingly, he's not here.
But,
yeah, that's right.
But he, this is something of great interest to him. So I do appreciate the opportunity to testify, and if, unless there are questions,
yes.
I would...
Yes, Representative Berger.
Senator Morris, have you got this in the form of a draft that you will be, of legislation that you will be submitting?
Yes, yes. What I think I've suggested to Representative Galizio is that we have it filed in the Senate, also filed in the House, and I suggested that I would be delighted to work with him on the House side. This is the subject of his academic pursuit, and as I understand, a terminal degree. So to the extent that it has, it's very important to him, and I'd be delighted to work with him on this.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Morris, certainly I'm aware that other states, including our neighbor to the north, have a form of an indirect initiative or an indirect petition. Are you aware of the experience of any states that have recently changed from a direct initiative to an indirect initiative?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. So now we'll get back to our other schedule and our witness, Kate Brown, our Oregon Secretary of State, and anyone you want to bring with you, Kate. That would be great. And again, for anybody who has come in, this is a general discussion for our group on the Rules Committee to start getting into the idea of what's out there with respect to initiative reform, and actually, if they wish, to talk a little bit about what we have done in the past and move forward. But it's really getting us in the framework for what work we're going to be doing this session. There are no bills. It's just an informational meeting. So with that.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. For the record, I'm Secretary of State Kate Brown, and I have with me to my right the Director of Elections Division, John Lindback, and to my left, Summer Davis. And I really appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy schedules to discuss Oregon's initiative system. I appreciate your interest in this topic. As you, most of you know, 24 states have some form of direct democracy, and Oregon is probably one of the most active and the least restrictive of those. I'm certainly a firm believer in Oregon's initiative system. It was, after all, what gave women the right to vote and allowed Oregonians to directly elect our United States senators. Beyond that, I figured any of the other measures that have passed would be somewhat controversial, so I started with those base, too. It is certainly part of our political DNA as Oregonians, and it allows Oregonians to participate with or against the legislature in lawmaking. As I traveled the many corners of the state last year, I heard from Oregonians who were extremely frustrated with our initiative process. They were particularly frustrated with the fraud and abuse happening in the signature gathering process. So the focus of my work this session will be on restoring integrity to Oregon's initiative system. First of all, fully implementing House Bill 2082, fighting for the resources to enforce the laws and rules in our signature gathering process. Last session we passed a bill. I think all of you participated in the passage, at least were present when it was voted on the floor. I call the bill IRMA, the Initiative Reform Modernization Act. Senator Rosenbaum put together the initial package in the House, and we made a few additions in the Senate. The bill required paid signature gatherers to register and get trained. It prohibited folks with convictions for fraud or ID theft from being paid signature gatherers. It holds chief petitioners liable for the acts of their signature gatherers, and it requires 1,000 signatures as opposed to 25 before moving forward on the ballot title process. It also allows for the enforcement of ballot measure 26, the no pay by signature, be requiring submission of accounting records. The bill also did a couple of things to make the process more citizen friendly. Petition sheets no longer have to be county specific. That's courtesy of our central voter registration database. And petitions can now be sent through the internet and printed and signed off the internet and then sent in. So in working with stakeholders, we're in the process of drafting legislation to fine-tune IRMA and give us some more tools to enforce the law we passed last session. The bill we are having drafted will include some of the following concepts. I'm not going to go through all of them today. It will require that signature sheets be turned in on a monthly basis with a calendar date set by administrative rule. And once a petition has received 50% of the required signatures, the Secretary of State may begin the verification process. It will allow for concurrent civil and criminal enforcement for elections violations relating to initiatives, and it will authorize the Secretary of State to reject signatures collected by an individual who's been convicted of fraud, and it will provide the Secretary of State with the authority to pull sheets collected by a circulator who has been found liable for an elections law violation under ORS 260. As you know, this is a complaint-driven process, or it has been up until recently. I frankly don't think we should be operating this way. I think the Secretary of State should be the policewoman or the policeman of our signature verification process. So a couple of things, a couple of changes that we have made. In January of 2008, Mr. Lindback pieced together the resources to hire an investigator, and I will be asking for additional resources in my budget to add two additional investigators. The other request I will be making of you is I'm asking for the resources to bring the signature verification process under the umbrella of the Secretary of State's office. I'm doing this for a couple of reasons. You may recall last year the federal court, Judge Mossman, heard the Lemons v. Bradbury case. And in it, the court expressed concern about the signature verification process. I believe by bringing the signature verification process under the auspices of the Secretary of State's office, we can promote uniformity and consistency in that process. And I also hope to ease the workload of our county clerks. So those are some of the things that I'm going to be working on this legislative session. I look forward to working with you as we promote integrity in Oregon's initiative system. And I am happy to answer any questions. And I, of course, brought my certified smart people to answer any of the difficult questions. So thank you very much.
Representative Garrard.
Madam Secretary, I just wanted to let you know that Bill Sizemore is one of my constituents.
Oh, that's good, Representative Garrard.
And I have no questions.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you.
Your last point, bringing the signature verification out of the counties and to the Secretary of State, are you saying all those original signatures then would be housed at the Secretary of State and not at the county level? Because isn't that what they do? No.
Essentially, we have access to that information now through the centralized voter registration database, but I'm going to let John respond to your question.
If you're talking about the signatures on the original voter registration cards, is
that no, I was talking about the initiative thing. How do they do it?
Well, right now, the signature sheets for state initiatives all come into us. We go through and we check them for circulator to make sure the circulators followed all the rules. Then we pull a sample so that some of them will be statistically sampled for whether or not they're a valid signature. And then we physically send the sheets to the county clerk to verify those signatures within their county or a group of signatures.
What are you proposing that would be different from that, I guess, is the question.
The actual verification of the signatures would take place in the Secretary of State's office rather than having send them to the county to have the county clerk do it.
And currently, for example, the clerk in Harney County may have gotten signatures to verify from Multnomah County. So they're not necessarily verifying signatures of folks within their county.
A clarifying question. So currently, when we fill out our registration card and we put our signature there, they are electronically putting that in a computer, and they're connected to the voter, and any one of the clerks can see that signature to verify it?
That's correct.
And we can see it at the state office as well, Mr. Chair.
So it's what you're basically doing is taking away the time that our county clerks are having their people look over verifying that signature, and you're saying people in your office will do that task?
Yes.
Using the same...
fee,
using,
of course.
Yeah.
that was my next question, Mr. Chair. Okay, I get it.
Just a point of clarification, Mr. Chair, it would be for state petitions. The county clerk would continue to verify signatures for county and city petitions.
Okay.
I doubt if the county clerks are going to complain.
Well, they may want to know if it cost them more money. They didn't get more money for it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, some of the county clerks don't want to lose this task, but my sense is that the majority of the county clerks are willing to give up this time-consuming task. And then I'm going to answer your question, even though you didn't ask it, and that was for the price tag.
Yes.
The total for the signature verification process and the two investigators is $524,000, and I would tell you it will be money well spent.
Representative Edwards.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Secretary Brown, I think you covered this already, but I missed it. Did we already change it so that the petition sheets can be in multiple counties or they're just in one county?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, we changed it so they can be in multiple counties.
Okay.
And that's courtesy, frankly, of our statewide voter registration database. But before, it used to be you had to, all your signature sheet would have to be from Multnomah County, Clackamas County, or Harney County. You couldn't have Harney County signatures on your Multnomah County sheet.
Yes.
So if somebody is circulating a petition, say, in the metropolitan Portland area, they could have signatures on a given sheet from Washington County, Multnomah County, and Clackamas County, and then... once you do your work, you have to send it to Clackamas County to verify signatures, and then they forward it or they send it back to you, and then it goes to Washington County, and then that same sheet goes to Multnomah County?
No. Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I don't think it would be that complicated, but essentially it used to be that, as John talked about, we would go through the initial process, the sheets would go back to the counties. They necessarily wouldn't have to go back. If there were three counties on one particular sheet, it wouldn't go to three counties, but it would go to a county for signature verification. What we're asking to do is have the signature verification process be housed in the Secretary of State's office.
Okay.
A clarification on that one. In the past, even, I might have Multnomah County. I take my sample, and I divide it up, and I send some off to Coos County, and they may be from any place. There wasn't a requirement that they had to be Coos County people when they were verifying. Was that true?
Prior to implementation of centralized voter registration, they were
had to be.
All from Coos County. But since that implementation, they are now being asked to verify them from any county in the state.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just
yes.
So you know, the county clerk from Harney County was quite upset that she was verifying from Multnomah County because, well, they didn't know the street addresses or anything. It was quite time-consuming for them. So.
Okay. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this proposal, are you proposing to change any of your sampling processes or structure or use the same one you've been using?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, not at this time. My understanding is that the scientific method we are using is statistically valid and that we're going to continue planning on continuing to use it.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Yeah, I'm still a little concerned or confused, or both. And welcome, Madam Secretary. It's good to see you, and kind of a pleasure to see you over on the other side. am I right that you're going to take jobs away from little ladies in Harney County that would otherwise be dependent upon the election every other year to pay for Christmas presents for their great-grandchildren?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, thank you. I'm just delighted to be on this side of the dais as well, though I much prefer asking the questions than answering them. My goal is to not take away jobs from either little old ladies or little old men in any counties. I think what we want to do is ease the workload and provide uniformity and consistency as we do the signature verification process.
Follow-up?
Yes.
It's my assumption, then, that the people working in the Secretary of State's office would be paid on the same type of salary sale that the people in the counties would be receiving for this work?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that question I cannot answer, but I'm sure John can answer, Mr. Lindback can answer.
Well, you know, I don't know how our salaries compare in the Secretary of State's office with the salaries in the county clerk's office. I don't know of any plans to change the salary scale on the basis of this proposal. The verifications now on state petitions are handled in at least in the great majority of counties, if not all of them, by the staff of the county clerk or the county clerk themselves. And so this proposal would relieve them of that duty and the liability of doing verifications on state petitions.
Yes, well, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this, and I hope you appreciate a little levity in the questions here. There is one issue, however, that does concern me as we get into this. It relates to the questions that I ask, and that is the issue of cost when we get down to it. Everything we do, it seems like, in this building costs money, and that's okay. That's part of what it's about. But it's also part of our responsibility as legislators, as you well know, to try to manage those costs in such a way that we're able to, get the best service for the least dollars that we possibly can. So, Mr. Chair, I assume as we proceed through discussion on this that in conjunction with the Secretary of State's office and various other things, we will be looking very carefully at the costs of this so that we can make sure that we're not creating something we didn't intend to.
Given our budget constraints, I think we'll be looking at every dollar.
Yeah. thank you very much for your indulgence with me, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? I guess my question has to do with the bills we passed, the pre-IRMA as opposed to the new IRMA. But it seems as though, from externally watching, that those went through fairly smoothly. Did we get compliance with respect to the records that were needed, necessary to show that they were paying people by the hour rather than by signature? Did we get the other parts of that bill. Did that implementation go fairly smoothly?
Mr. Chair, are you talking pre-IRMA?
No, this last, didn't IRMA go into effect?
During the election cycle.
Correct.
So, actually, Mr. Lindbeck.
Yeah. you're talking about the portion of IRMA that required the chief petitioners to submit their financial information to us so that we could verify that they were paying people by, not, that they were not paying,
not paying
people
by
the signature.
Yes.
We had, we reported on this last summer to the rules committees, and there were some chief petitioners that clearly had trouble with this requirement, and their petitions were suspended as a result of it. That's one authority under IRMA that the Secretary of State's office has. If we don't get that information, we have the authority to suspend their drive, and it did affect their ability to make the ballot. But by the time we were all done, most had complied, but there were some that had trouble.
Mr. Chair, if it's useful, I actually have the presentation from the August 2008 meeting, if the committee would like it, and we can certainly provide it via the Internet if that's more helpful to committee members.
I think that would be great. We have new people on the committee, and it would be a great service, so thank you. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, if I may add one other sort of factoid from House Bill 28, there was only one initiative that gathered post-implementation of House Bill 2082, and that was Ballot Measure 65. The validity rate in Ballot Measure 65 was in the neighborhood, in terms of the signatures, was in the neighborhood of 75%, which was substantially higher than the signature validity rate in all of the other ballot measures that were submitted that were actually made it to the ballot. And their validity rate was in the neighborhood of 64% to 65%, and we can get you that information on the specific ballot measures as well. So,
other questions? Thank you very much. I assume we will, I'm assured, we will be seeing you in the future.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
And now Ryan Deckert, Oregon Business Association. And whoever you'd like to bring, Ryan. That's good. And Tim will be up here, too, because we had you as well. So that'd be great. We'll let you go first, Ryan.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Ryan Deckert, President of the Oregon Business Association. OBA advocates for the long-term enhancement of Oregon's business environment and quality of life, providing statewide business leadership that strives to ensure Oregon's long-term prosperity. Our members include businesses of all sizes and industries throughout the state, from our largest farm in the state to Oregon's two Fortune 500 companies. Mr. Chair, we came to this issue about a year ago after receiving the City Club of Portland, which did an exhaustive report around the initiative process and concluded, in short, that the one thing missing from our citizen initiative process is citizens. As we looked at the initiative process and all the derivative outcomes of it, we found many abuses in the way that signatures are gathered, and confusing, I think Senator Morse really alluded to this, confusing language when presented to Oregon voters. And that's where we came at a series of reforms that I think you'll hear about today, and they really fall into three areas, led by Senator Morse, Representative Galizio, and then a broad coalition of, I think at the last meeting that we had around restoring integrity to the initiative process, almost everyone was there, from labor, from business, from good government groups like the League of Women Voters, a broad coalition hoping to restore some integrity to our initiative process. And the three areas that the proposals I believe you will see come to you, one is around constitutional choices that this legislature may or may not entertain giving voters input on, and the indirect initiative has been the one that has been the most hotly debated, although there are a couple others, and I think the League is at least investigating and exploring another proposal around limiting subject areas, which other states have employed, we think, pretty effectively. The second area of work and proposals comes around ballot title reform, and I know the Revenue Reform Task Force, which Tim has played an important role, Mr. Nesbitt, is looking at a series of proposals around reforming the ballot title process. The third area, Mr. Chair, is signature gathering process, and I think Secretary of State Brown spoke to that, but we believe there will be a series of proposals embodied in Representative Galizio and Senator Morse's bill, and we wholeheartedly, at least at this point, support all three of those areas, the signature gathering, the ballot title, and at least exploring constitutional indirect initiatives that would give you, the elected representatives, the ability to ask some questions before a measure goes right to the ballot. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I appreciate the work that has been done and the number of people that have been involved. Any questions of Ryan before I move on? Tim.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt. I'm Deputy Chief of Staff for the Governor, and my background includes authoring what became Ballot Measure 26 that banned payment by the signature in the 2002 election cycle, as well as involvement, as Ryan said, in the Revenue Task Force, where although it may seem somewhat unrelated to the task of that task force, it was concluded that with recommendations to stabilize our revenue system by boosting our reserves, we want to make sure that we're not setting it up so that those who sponsor these ballot proposals can simply raid the reserves by bringing forth more and more unfunded mandates or other measures which unbalance the budget. If you put a lot more work into making sure the budget stays balanced and the revenue streams are stabilized. So that was the motivation there. And also, I was invited to participate in the work groups convened by the Oregon Business Association, and in particular, to head up a work group on reforms focused on the ballot title process itself. Also involved in that were representatives of AOI and the Oregon Restaurant Association. And so we brought forward what you see outlined here in conceptual form to the OBA group just last month. And we really focused on two things. One, what should be required before a final ballot title is issued, and we go through that whole complicated and sometimes expensive process of adjudicating challenges to the ballot title. That's important because, as I observed over the last decade or more, the development of what has become kind of the operations manual for those who sponsor initiatives one election cycle after another, including Representative Girard's constituent, it became more and more clear that that the advantage they had and the advantage they were, to some extent, I think, I think they were using this advantage in a way in which the law was not intended, and that was to file many different ballot measures in order to get a winning ballot title, one which looks compelling and seductive to the voters at those 15-word captions, and then owning that title, going forward and doing polling on it to kind of figure out what the voters think on first impression. Remember that ballot title creates a first impression, which is sometimes hard to overcome on a long list of measures on the ballot, and then going and fundraising with that and the poll results. And so there developed over time this kind of a business model for how to use the initiative process based on the ease of getting a final ballot title, which once you have it, before you've collected any significant number of signatures, is final and immutable. It's what voters are going to see on the ballot. So that became kind of a political asset in the way this whole process developed over the last decade or more. We think it's certainly plausible that if we had enough time, we don't always, because of the way signatures are turned in at the end of June or early July, and you have to be posting a ballot title by the month of September. But if we had enough time, it would make sense to reserve the award of a final ballot title until someone's turned in signatures and has actually turned a ballot proposal into a ballot measure. We don't necessarily have enough time for that. The legislation you heard described as IRMA in the last session certainly helped a lot by raising the threshold for getting a final ballot title from 25 to 1,000 signatures. So under current law, what happens with the submission of 1,000 signatures is
You get a review as to compliance for the single subject or single amendment rules. At certain times, the Secretary of State, on the advice of the AG, has rejected a submission with those 25 or now 1,000 signatures. So you get that determination. You also get the draft ballot title. You get comment period. You get the final ballot title, and you get the right to appeal to court. And then you get the most important part here, the approval to circulate. We think it makes sense to continue to connect the approval to circulate with an initial determination on whether your proposal qualifies as a single amendment to the Constitution or a single subject statutory change. We don't think it necessarily makes sense to have the award of a final ballot title keyed to the submission of those signatures. Now, there are a lot of complicated workload and mechanical problems here, and we want to make sure that if we make any changes, that we're not kind of overloading the ballot title pipeline towards the end of this timeline so the courts would be backlogged. But if you do consider a change where there's periodic submissions of signatures, as the Secretary of State just suggested, and where there can be a verification starting at some point in the process, as the Secretary just proposed, starting when sponsors have submitted half the required signatures, you could move the ballot titling process back to that point. It would probably occur over different months in the calendar. It would definitely mean there'd be far fewer ballot titles having to be issued. There'd be far fewer ballot titles appealed to the court. There'd be reduction in workload and reduction in cost. But the balancing act here is to make sure that it's not something which overloads the process at the very end. So we've just outlined how that process might look. The advantages on the back page of my handout there are that initiative sponsors would avoid having their approval to circulate held up by legal challenges, which is the case now. Someone could have a fairly good ballot title, but opponents know they can slow them down just by quibbling over that title. That motivates appeals, which often turn out to be without merit. But they will also lose the advantage of securing a mutable ballot title, one that can't be changed, before they've even launched their signature-gathering campaign. So the ballot title would become truly what its name implies, a title you get when you're on the ballot, or when it looks like there's been enough of a showing of interest in the form of signatures submitted that you're likely to qualify for the ballot. There will be far fewer initiatives that require completion of the ballot title process, far fewer appeals to the courts, and cost savings for the state. And then potential petition signers, however, would have to rely on a kind of a circulating summary in lieu of a ballot title. But in my years of observing the interaction of petitioners and petition signers, that's not really going to be a major problem if you have a summary rather than a title. I don't think that, since you're also required by law to carry the full text of the initiative, I don't think that's a major problem. So we offer that for your consideration. Number two, the second area besides what's required to get a ballot title that we think deserves attention is how can ballot titles be better presented to improve voters' understanding of both their complexities and their costs. And again, right now, current system, you have that 15-word caption, and proponents out there talk about killer ballot titles, and it's all about positioning, filing, and maneuvering to get that very compelling 15-word title, which kind of shrink-wraps what could be a whole complexity of issues going to the voters that really can't be captured in those 15 words. But that's how the system works now, so those are the games that are played around that system. We think we should be looking at ways in which, without necessarily expanding the verbiage that voters see on the ballots and the expense counties would have to go through to print a longer ballot, to take the same number of words and instead of having a caption of 15 words, a yes-no statements, which often repeat themselves, 25 words each, and sometimes a county will have the 125-word summary and sometimes not, to kind of boil that down to a paragraph which is going to be, which might require the voter to read more than 15 words, but which will tell the voter more about the impact of the measure. Secondly, to provide clearer notice to voters of the financial impact of measures that would unbalance the state's budget, and this is what came to our attention from the work of the Revenue Task Force. We now tell voters that there's a constitutional amendment, amends Constitution. Those words appear right up front. We think there could be similar cautionary language applied to any measure which has a significant fiscal impact, which would, in fact, unbalance the budget, either by reducing revenues or resources available for the services that are now supported, or by mandating new expenditures without the funding for them, the so-called unfunded mandates. We've looked at different variations of language here which might be used. We're still doing work, and we'll be working with the business associations to sponsor some focus groups to really get a better sense of what works better to better inform the voters about both the complexities and the cost impacts of these measures. So three ideas. I think the first one is more elaborate in terms of having to change the process for the award of a final ballot title, but the other two could be done fairly simply. They all could be done through statutory changes. So we offer these for your consideration.
Questions? Not seeing a lot. I had one a second ago. Oh, it really had to go with the previous
bills that we passed. Did we have a ballot measure that had to have 1,000 signatures gathered this last time?
Well, the...
We didn't. Okay, that's what I thought.
Measure 65, I believe, was the
home. I think there was one, Measure 65. Yeah.
Had to... Mr. Chairman, Measure 65 was the only one that had to operate under the new IRMA rules.
Okay.
All the others, it was pretty interesting testimony that Secretary Brown had around the different validity
rates. It was
rates.
The only one, okay.
Yeah.
But it... wait.
It required 1,000 signatures.
All the rest of IRMA was in place. That was
all
a different law.
The 2010 required bill, and only those that were filed after January 1st, 2008.
Okay.
Glad that's
Thank
not
you.
On the record.
Hey, it's okay. Other questions? Seeing none, I want to thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
I know, this one went by pretty quickly. What I really wanted to let people start thinking about was this is kind of the range of things that I've seen. I anticipate there may be others. We haven't necessarily seen them coming yet to our committee, but the expectation is that we will be addressing these issues, and I wanted to give you guys a heads up so you can start thinking about those and what effects they might have. And if you have other people who are involved in this business and doing a lot of it, to get their input, make sure that they understand that there are some changes that we're looking at, and we would love to have the input from people around the state who are actually doing the initiative process, especially those that are in our little homes and communities that have gone out and tried to do this process. Yes, Representative Guerrero.
I'll consult with my constituent.
Any other business before our committee? Seeing none, we will adjourn our Rules Committee. Thank you very much.